Welcome to Jaded YA Reads, a YA read-aloud podcast for teens, tweens, and adults, brought to you by the Wells Public Library. This season, we'll be reading The Inheritance Games by Jennifer Lynn Barnes, with permissions from Little, Brown, and Company. Chapter 8. The great room was two-thirds the size of the foyer. An enormous stone fireplace stood at the front. There were gargoyles carved into the sides of the fireplace. Literal gargoyles. Grayson deposited Libby and me into wing-back chairs, and then excused himself to the front of the room, where three older gentlemen in suits stood, talking to Zara and her husband. The lawyers, I realized. After another few minutes, Elisa joined them, and I took stock of the other occupants of the room, a white couple, older, in their 60s at least, a black man, 40s, with a military bearing, who stood with his back to a wall and maintained a clear line of sight to both exits. Xander, with what was clearly another Hawthorne brother by his side. This one was older, mid-20s. He needed a haircut and paired his suit with cowboy boots that, like the motorcycle outside, had seen better days. Nash, I thought, recalling the name that Elisa had provided. Finally, an ancient woman joined the fray. Nash offered her an arm, but she took Xander's instead. He led her straight to Libby and me. "This is Nan," he told us. "The woman, the legend." "Get on with you," she swatted his arm. "I'm this rascal's great-grandmother," Nan settled, with no small difficulty, into the open seat beside me. "Older than dirt and twice as mean." "She's a softie," Xander assured me cheerfully, "and I'm her favorite." "You are not my favorite," Nan grumbled. "I'm everyone's favorite," Xander grinned. "Far too much like that incorrigible grandfather of yours," Nan grunted. She closed her eyes and I saw her hands shake slightly. Awful man. There was a tenderness there. "Was Mr. Hawthorne your son?" Libby asked gently. She worked with the elderly, and she was a good listener. Nan welcomed the opportunity to snort again. "Son-in-law." "He was also her favorite," Xander clarified. There was something poignant in the way he said it. This wasn't a funeral. They must have laid the man to rest weeks earlier, but I knew grief, could feel it, could practically smell it. "Are you all right, Ave?" Libby asked beside me. I thought back to Grayson telling me how expressive my face was. Better to think about Grayson Hawthorne than funerals and grieving. "I'm fine," I told Libby, "but I wasn't. Even after 2 years, missing my mom could hit me like a tsunami. I'm going to step outside," I said, forcing a smile. "I just need some air." Zara's husband stopped me on my way out. "Where are you going? We're about to start." He locked a hand over my elbow. I wrenched my arm out of his grasp. I didn't care who these people were. No one got to lay hands on me. "I was told there are 4 Hawthorne grandsons," I said, my voice steely. "By my count, you're still down by one. I'll be back in a minute. You won't even notice I'm gone." I ended up in the backyard instead of the front, if you could even call it a yard. The grounds were immaculately kept. There was a fountain, a statue garden, a greenhouse, and stretching into the distance as far as I could see, land. Some of it was treed, some was open. But it was easy enough, standing there and looking out, to imagine that a person who walked off to the horizon might never make their way back. If yes is no, and once is never, then how many sides does a triangle have? The question came from above. I looked up and saw a boy sitting on the edge of a balcony overhead, balanced precariously on a wrought iron railing, drunk. "You're going to fall," I told him. He smirked. "An interesting proposition." "That wasn't a proposition," I said. He offered me a lazy grin. There's no shame in propositioning a Hawthorne. He had hair darker than Grayson's and lighter than Xander's. He wasn't wearing a shirt. Always a good decision in the middle of winter, I thought. But I couldn't keep my gaze from traveling downward from his face. His torso was lean, his stomach defined. He had a long, thin scar that ran from collarbone to hip. "You must be Mystery Girl," he said. "I'm Avery," I corrected. I'd come out here to get away from the Hawthorns and their grief. There wasn't a trace of care on this boy's face, like life was one grand lark, like he wasn't grieving just as much as the people inside were. "Whatever you say, M.G.," he retorted. "Can I call you M.G., Mystery Girl?" I crossed my arms. No. He brought his feet up on the railing and stood. He wobbled, and I had a moment of chilling prescience. He's grieving, and he's too high up. I hadn't allowed myself to self-destruct when my mom died. That didn't mean I hadn't felt the call. He shifted his weight to one foot and held the other out. Don't! Before I could say anything else, the boy twisted and grabbed the railing with his hands, holding himself vertical, feet in the air. I could see the muscles in his back tensing, rippling over his shoulder blades, as he lowered himself and dropped. He landed right beside me. You shouldn't be out here, MG. I wasn't the shirtless one who just jumped off a balcony. Neither should you. I wondered if he could tell how fast my heart was beating. I wondered if his was racing at all. If I do what I should know more often than what I say, what I shouldn't, his lips twisted, then what does that make me? Jameson Hawthorne, I thought. Up close, I could make out the color of his eyes, a dark, fathomless green. What, he repeated intently, does that make me? I stopped looking at his eyes, and his abs, and his haphazardly gelled hair. Drunk, I said, and then, because I could sense an annoying comeback, I added two more words. And two. What? Jameson Hawthorne said. The answer to your first riddle, I told him. If yes is no, and once is never, then the number of sides of a triangle has... Then the number of sides a triangle has is two. I drew up my reply, not bothering to explain how I'd arrived at the answer. Touché, M.G. Jason ambled past me, brushing his bare arm lightly over mine as he did. Touché. Chapter 9. I stayed out back a few minutes longer. Nothing about this day felt real, and tomorrow I'd go back to Connecticut a little richer, hopefully, and with a story to tell, and I'd probably never see any of the Hawthorns again. I'd never have a view like this again. By the time I returned to the great room, Jameson Hawthorne had miraculously managed to find a shirt and a suit jacket. He smiled in my direction and gave a little salute. Beside him, Grayson stiffened, his jaw muscles tensing. Now that everyone is here, one of the lawyers said, let's get started. The three lawyers stood in triangle formation. The one who'd spoken shared Elisa's dark hair, brown skin, and self-assured expressions. I assumed he was the Ortega in McNamara, Ortega, and Jones. The other two, presumably Jones and McNamara, stood to either side. Since when does it take four lawyers to read a will? I thought. You are here, Mr. Ortega said, projecting his voice to the corners of the room, to hear the last will and testament of Tobias Tattersall Hawthorne. Per Mr. Hawthorne's instructions, my colleagues will now distribute letters he has left for each of you. The other men began to make the rounds of the room, handing out envelopes one by one. You may open these letters when the reading is concluded. I was handed an envelope. My full name was written in calligraphy on the front. Beside me, Libby looked up at the lawyer, but he passed over her and went on delivering envelopes to the other occupants of the room. Mr. Hawthorne stipulated that all of the following individuals must be physically present for the reading of this will. Sky Hawthorne, Zara Hawthorne Caligaris, Nash Hawthorne, Grayson Hawthorne, Jameson Hawthorne, Alexander Hawthorne, and Ms. Avery Kylie Grahams of Newcastle, Connecticut. I felt as conspicuous as I would have if I looked down and discovered that I wasn't wearing clothes. Since you are all here, Mr. Ortega continued, we may begin. Beside me, Libby slipped her hand into mine. I, Tobias Tattersall Hawthorne, Mr. Ortega read, being of sound body and mind, decree that my worldly possessions, including all monetary and physical assets, be disposed of as follows. To Andrew and Lottie Laughlin, for years of loyal service, I bequeath a sum of $100,000 apiece, with lifelong rent-free tenancy granted in Wayback Cottage, located on the western border of my Texas estate. The older couple I'd seen earlier leaned into each other. All I could think of was $100,000. The Laughlin's presence wasn't mandatory for the reading of the will, and they'd just been given $100,000 apiece. I tried very hard to remember how to breathe. To John Oren, head of my security detail, who has saved my life more times and in more ways than I can count, I leave the contents of my toolbox, held currently in the offices of McNamara, Ortega, and Jones, as well as a sum of $300,000. Tobias Hawthorne knew these people, I told myself, heart-thumping. They worked for him. They mattered to him. I'm nothing. To my mother-in-law, Pearl O'Day, I leave an annuity of $100,000 a year, plus a trust for medical expenses as set forth in the appendix. All jewelry belonging to my late wife, Alice O'Day Hawthorne, shall pass to her mother upon my death, to be distributed as she sees fit upon hers. Nan harumphed. Don't you go getting any ideas, she ordered the room at large. I'm going to outlive you all. Mr. Ortega smiled, but then that smile faltered. He paused and then tried again. To my daughter Zara Hawthorne Caligaris and Sky Hawthorne, I leave the funds necessary to pay off all debts accrued as of the date and time of my death. Mr. Ortega paused again, his lips pushing themselves together. The other two lawyers stared straight ahead, avoiding looking at any member of the Hawthorne family directly. Additionally, I leave to Sky my compass. May she always know true north, and to Zara I leave my wedding ring. May she love as wholly and steadfastly as I loved her mother. Another pause, more painful than the last. Go on, that came from Zara's husband. To each of my daughters, Mr. Ortega read slowly, beyond that already stated, I leave a one-time inheritance of $50,000. $50,000? I no sooner thought those words than Zara's husband echoed them out loud, irate. Tobias Hawthorne left his daughters less than he left his security detail. Suddenly, Skye's reference to Grayson as the heir apparent took on a whole new meaning. You did this, Zara turned toward Skye. She didn't raise her voice, but it was deadly all the same. Me, Skye said, indignant. Daddy was never the same after Toby died, Zara continued. Disappeared, Skye corrected. God, listen to you, Zara lost her hold on her tone. You got in his head, didn't you, Skye? Batted your eyelashes and convinced him to bypass us and leave everything to your sons. Skye's voice was crisp. The word you're looking for is sons. The word she's looking for is bastards. Nash Hawthorne had the thickest Texas accent of anyone in the room. Not like we haven't heard it before. If I'd had a son, Zara's voice caught. But you didn't. Skye let that sink in. Did you, Zara? Enough. Zara's husband stepped in. We will sort this out. I'm afraid there's nothing to be sorted, Mr. Ortega re-entered the fray. You will find the will is ironclad, with significant disincentives to any who might be tempted to challenge it. I translated that to mean, roughly, shut up and sit down. Now, if I may continue, Mr. Ortega looked back at the will in his hands. To my grandsons, Nash Westbrook Hawthorne, Grayson Davenport Hawthorne, Jameson Winchester Hawthorne, and Alexander Blackwood Hawthorne, I leave everything, Zara muttered bitterly. Mr. Ortega spoke over her. $250,000 apiece, payable on their 25th birthdays until such time to be managed by Elisa Ortega, trustee. What? Elisa sounded shocked. I mean, what? The hell, Nash told her pleasantly. The phrase you're looking for, darling, is what the hell? Tobias Hawthorne hadn't left everything to his grandsons. Given the scope of his fortune, he'd left them a pittance. What's going on here? Grayson asked, each word deadly and precise. Tobias Hawthorne didn't leave everything to his grandsons. He didn't leave everything to his daughters. My brain ground to a halt right there. My ears rang. Please, everyone, Mr. Ortega held up a hand. Allow me to finish. $46.2 billion, I thought, my heart attacking my ribcage and my mouth sandpaper dry. Tobias Hawthorne was worth $46.2 billion, and he left his grandsons $1 million combined. 100,000 total to his daughters, another $500,000 to his servants, an annuity for Nan. The math in this equation did not add up. It couldn't add up. One by one, the other occupants of the room turned to stare at me. The remainder of my estate, Mr. Ortega read, including all properties, monetary assets, and worldly possessions not otherwise specified. I leave to Avery Kylie Gray. Chapter 10. This is not happening. This cannot be happening. I'm dreaming. I'm delusional. He left everything to her? Skye's voice was shrill enough to break through my stupor. Why? Gone was the woman who mused over my astrological sign and regaled me with tales of her sons and lovers. This Skye looked like she could kill someone. Literally. Who the hell is she? Zara's voice was knife-edged and clear as a bell. There must be some mistake, Grayson spoke out like a person used to dealing with mistakes. Bribe, threaten, buyout, I thought. What would the heir apparent do to me? This is not happening. I felt that with every beat of my heart, every breath in, every breath out. This cannot be happening. He's right. My words came out in a whisper, lost to voices being raised all around me. I tried again louder. Grayson's right. Heads started turning in my direction. There must be some mistake. My voice was hoarse. I felt like I'd jumped out of a plane, like I was skydiving and waiting for my chute to open. This is not real. It can't be. Avery, Libby nudged me in the ribs, clearly telegraphing that I should shut up and stop talking about mistakes. But there was no way. There had to be some kind of mix-up. A man I'd never met hadn't just left me a multi-billion-dollar fortune. Things like that didn't happen, period. You see? Skye latched on to what I said. Even Ava agrees this is ridiculous. This time, I was pretty sure she had gotten my name wrong on purpose. The remainder of my estate, including all properties, monetary assets, and worldly possessions not otherwise specified, I leave to Avery Kylie Grahams. Skye Hawthorne knew my name now. They all did. I assure you there is no mistake, Mr. Ortega met my gaze, then turned his attention to the others. And I assure the rest of you, Tobias Hawthorne's last will and testament is utterly unbreakable. Since the majority of the remaining details concern only Avery, we'll cease with the dramatics. But let me make one thing very clear. Per the terms of the will, any heir who challenges Avery's inheritance will forfeit their share of the estate entirely. Avery's inheritance. I felt dizzy, almost nauseous. It was like someone had snapped their fingers and rewritten the laws of physics. Like the coefficient of gravity had changed, and my body was ill-suited to coping. The world was spinning off its axis. No will is that ironclad, Zara's husband said, his voice acidic. Not when there's this kind of money at stake. Spoken, Nash Hawthorne interjected, like someone who really didn't know the old man. Traps upon traps, Jameson murmured, and riddles upon riddles. I could feel his dark green eyes on mine. I think you should leave, Grayson told me curtly. Not a request, an order. Technically, Elisa Ortega sounded like she just swallowed arsenic. It's her house. Clearly, she really hadn't known what was in the will. She'd been kept in the dark, just like the family. How could Tobias Hawthorne blindside them like this? What kind of person does that to their own flesh and blood? I don't understand, I said out loud, dizzy and numb, because none of this made any kind of sense. My daughter is correct, Mr. Ortega kept his tone neutral. You own it all, Miss Grahams. Not just the fortune, but all of Mr. Hawthorne's properties, including Hawthorne House. Per the terms of your inheritance, which I will gladly go over with you, the current occupants have been granted tenancy, unless, and until, they give you cause for removal. He let those words hang in the air. Under no circumstances, he continued gravely, his words rife with warning, can those tenants attempt to remove you. The room was suddenly silent and still. They're going to kill me. Someone in this room is actually going to kill me. The man I pegged as former military strode to stand between me and Tobias Hawthorne's family. He said nothing, crossing his arms over his chest, keeping me behind him and the rest of them in his sight. Orin! Zara sounded shocked. I worked for Mr. Hawthorne. John Orin paused and held up a piece of paper. It took me a moment to realize that it was his letter. It was his last request that I continue in the employment of Miss Avery Kylie Grahams. He glanced at me. Security, you'll need it. And not just to protect you from us, Xander added to my left. Take a step back, please, Orin ordered. Xander held his hands up. Peace, he declared. I make dire... You work for this family. Predictions in peace. Zan's right, Jameson smiled, like this was all a game. The entire world's going to want a piece of you, mystery girl. This has story of the century written all over it. Story of the century. My brain kicked back into gear, because there was every indication that this wasn't a joke. I wasn't delusional. I wasn't dreaming. I was an heiress. Chapter 11. I bolted. The next thing I knew, I was outside. The front door of Hawthorne House slammed behind me. Cool air hit my face. I was almost sure I was breathing, but my entire body felt distant and numb. Was this what shock felt like? Avery! Libby burst out of the house after me. Are you okay? She studied me, concerned. Also, are you insane? When someone gives you money, you don't try to give it back. You do, I pointed out, the roar in my brain, so loud that I couldn't hear myself think. Every time I try to give you my tips. We're not talking tips here, Libby's blue hair was falling out of her ponytail. We're talking millions. Billions, I corrected silently, but my mouth flat out refused to say the word. Ave, Libby put a hand on my shoulder. Think about what this means. You'll never have to worry about money again. You can buy whatever you want, do whatever you want. Those postcards you kept of your mom's? She leaned forward, touching her forehead against mine. You can go anywhere. Imagine the possibilities. I did, even though this felt like a cruel joke. Like the universe's way of tricking me into wanting things that girls like me were never meant to. The massive front door of Hawthorne House slammed open. I jumped back, and Nash Hawthorne stepped out. Even wearing a suit, he looked every inch the cowboy, ready to meet a rival at high noon. I braced myself. Billions. Wars had been fought over less. Relax, kid. Nash's Texas drawl was slow and smooth, like whiskey. I don't want the money. Never have. Far as I'm concerned, this is the universe having a bit of fun with folks who probably deserve it. The oldest Hawthorne's brother's gaze drifted from me to Libby. He was tall, muscular, and suntanned. She was tiny and slight, her pale skin standing in stark contrast to her dark lipstick and neon hair. The two of them looked like they didn't belong within 10 feet of each other, and yet, there he was, slow smiling at her. "You take care, darling," Nash told my sister. He ambled towards his motorcycle, then put on his helmet, and a moment later he was gone. Libby stared after the motorcycle. "I take back what I said about Grayson. Maybe he's God." Right now, we had bigger issues than which of the Hawthorne brothers was divine. "We can't stay here, Libby. I doubt the rest of the family is as blasé about the will as Nash is. We need to go." "I'm going with you," a deep voice said. I turned. John Orin stood next to the front door. I hadn't heard him open it. "I don't need security," I told him. "I just need to get out of here." "You'll need security for the rest of your life." He was so matter-of-fact, I couldn't even begin to argue. "But look on the bright side," I nodded to the car that had picked us up at the airport. "I also drive." I asked Orin to take us to a motel. Instead, he drove us to the fanciest hotel I'd ever seen, and he must have taken the scenic route because Elisa Ortega was waiting for us in the lobby. "I've had a chance to read the will in full." Apparently, that was her version of hello. "I brought a copy for you. I suggest we retire to your rooms and go over the details." "Our rooms?" I repeated. The doormen were wearing tuxedos. There were 6 chandeliers in the lobby. Nearby, a woman was playing a 5-foot-tall harp. "We can't afford rooms here." Elisa gave me an almost pitying look. "Oh, honey," she said, then recovered her professionalism. "You own this hotel." What? Libby and I were getting "who let the rabble in" looks from the other patrons just standing in the lobby. I could not possibly own this hotel. "Besides which," Elisa continued, "the will is now in probate. It may be some time before the money and properties are out of escrow, But in the meantime, McNamara, Ortega, and Jones will be picking up the tab for anything you need. Libby frowned, crinkling her brow. Is that a thing that law firms do? You've probably gathered that Mr. Hawthorne was one of our most important clients, Elisa said delicately. It would be more precise to say that he was our only client. And now? Now, I said, the truth sinking in. That client is me. It took me almost an hour to read and reread and re-reread the will. Tobias Hawthorne had put only one condition on my inheritance. You're to live in Hawthorne House for 1 year, commencing no more than 3 days from now. Elisa had made that point at least twice already, but I couldn't get my brain to accept it. The only string attached to my inheriting billions of dollars is that I must move into a mansion. Correct. A mansion where a large number of people who were expecting to inherit this money still live, and I can't kick them out. Barring extraordinary circumstances, also correct. If it is any consolation, it is a very large house. And if I refuse, I asked, or if the Hawthorne family has me killed? No one is going to have you killed, Elisa said calmly. I know you grew up around these people and everything, Libby told Elisa, trying to be diplomatic, but they are totally, 100% going to go all Lizzie Borden on my sister. Really would prefer not to be axe murdered, I emphasized. Risk assessment low, Oren rumbled, at least insofar as axes are concerned. It took me a second to figure out that he was joking. This is serious. Believe me, he returned, I know. But I also know the Hawthorne family. The boys would never harm a woman, and the woman would come for you in the courtroom, no axes involved. Besides, Lisa added, in the state of Texas, if an heir dies while a will is in probate, the inheritance doesn't revert to the original estate. It becomes part of the heir's estate. I have an estate, I thought dully. And if I refuse to move in with them, I asked again, a giant ball in my throat. She's not going to refuse, Libby shot laser eyes in my direction. If you fail to move into Hawthorne House in three days' time, Elisa told me, your portion of the estate will be dispersed to charity. Not to Tobias Hawthorne's family? I asked. No. Elisa's neutral mask slipped slightly. She'd known the Hawthornes for years. She might work for me now, but she couldn't be happy about that. Could she? Your father wrote the will, right? I said, trying to wrap my head around the insane situation I was in. In consultation with the other partners at the firm, Elisa confirmed. Did he tell you? I tried to find a better way to phrase what I wanted to ask, then gave up. Did he tell you why? Why had Tobias Hawthorne disinherited his family? Why leave everything to me? I don't think my father knows why, Elisa said. She peered at me, the neutral mask slipping once more. Chapter 12. Motherfaxing elf, Max breathed. Goat dram, motherfaxing elf. She lowered her voice to a whisper and let out an actual expletive. It was past midnight for me, and 2 hours earlier for her. I half expected Mrs. Lou to sweep in and snatch the phone away, but nothing happened. How? Max demanded. Why? I looked down at the letter in my lap. Tobias Hawthorne had left me an explanation, but in the hours since the will was read, I hadn't been able to bring myself to open the envelope. I was alone, sitting in the dark on the balcony of a penthouse suite of a hotel that I owned, wearing a plush, floor-length robe that probably cost more than my car, and I was frozen. Maybe, Max thought thoughtfully, you were switched at birth. Max watched a lot of television and had what you could probably have been classified as a book addiction. Maybe your mother saved his life years ago. Maybe he owes his entire fortune to your great-great-grandfather. Maybe you were selected via an advanced computer algorithm that is poised to develop artificial intelligence any day. Maxine, I snorted. Somehow that was enough to allow me to say the exact words I'd been trying not to think. Maybe my father isn't really my father. That was the most rational explanation, wasn't it? Maybe Tobias Hawthorne hadn't disinherited his family for a stranger. Maybe I was family. I have a secret. I pictured my mom in my mind. How many times had I heard her say those exact words? You okay? Max asked on the other end of the line. I looked down at the envelope, at my name in calligraphy on the front, I swallowed. Tobias Hawthorne left me a letter. "And you haven't opened it yet?" Max said. "Avery, for fuck's sakes!" "Maxine!" Even over the phone, I could hear Max's mom in the background. "Fox, Mama." I said fox, as in, for the sake of foxes and their furry little tails. There was a brief pause, and then, "Avery, I have to go." My stomach muscles tightened. "Talk soon?" "Very soon," Max promised. "And in the meantime, open the letter." She hung up. I hung up. I put my thumb underneath the lip of the envelope, but a knock at the door saved me from following through. Back in the suite, I found Orin positioned at the door. "Who is it?" I asked him. "Grayson Hawthorne," Orin replied. I stared at the door, and Orin elaborated. "If my men considered him a threat, he never would have made it to our floor. I trust Grayson, but if you don't want to see him..." "No," I said. "What am I doing? It was late." And I doubted American royalty took kindly to being dethroned. But there was something about the way Grayson had looked at me from the first time we'd met. "Open the door," I told Orin. He did, and then he stepped back. "Aren't you going to invite me in?" Grayson wasn't the heir anymore, but you wouldn't have known it from his tone. "You shouldn't be here," I told him, pulling my robe tighter around me. "I've spent the past hour telling myself much of the same thing, and yet here I am." His eyes were pools of gray, his hair unkempt, like I wasn't the only one who hadn't been able to sleep. He'd lost everything today. "Grayson," I said. "I don't know how you did this," he cut me off, his voice dangerous and soft. "I don't know what hold you had over my grandfather, or what kind of con you're running here." "I'm talking right now, Miss Grams." He placed his hand flat on the door. I'd been wrong about his eyes. They weren't pools. They were ice. "I haven't a clue how you pulled this off, but I will find out. I see you now. I know what you are and what you're capable of, and there is nothing I wouldn't do to protect my family. Whatever game you're playing here, no matter how long this con, I will find the truth, and God help you when I do." Orin stepped into my peripheral vision, and I didn't wait for him to act. I pushed the door forward, hard enough to send Grayson back, then slammed it closed. Heart pounding, I waited for him to knock again, to shout through the door. Nothing. Slowly, my head bowed, my eyes drawn like magnet to metal by the envelope in my hands. With one last glance at Orin, I retreated to my bedroom. Open the letter. This time, I did it, removing a card from the envelope. The body of the message was only 2 words long. I stared at the page, reading the salutation, the message, and the signature, over and over again. "Dearest Avery, I'm sorry. TTH." Chapter 13. Sorry? Sorry for what? The question was still ringing in my mind the next morning. For once in my life, I'd slept late. I found Orin and Elisa in our suite's kitchen talking softly. Too softly for me to hear. "Avery," Orin noticed me first. I wondered if he'd told Elisa about Grayson. "There are some security protocols I'd like to go over with you."
"Like not opening doors to Grayson Hawthorne?"
"You're a target now," Elisa told me crisply. Given that she'd been so insistent that the Hawthorns weren't a threat, I had to ask. A target for what? Paparazzi, of course. The firm is keeping a lid on the story for the time being, but that won't last, and there are other concerns. Kidnapping. Orin didn't put any particular emphasis on that word. Stalking. People will make threats, they always do. You're young and you're female, and that will make it worse. With your sister's permission, I'll arrange a detail for her as well, as soon as she gets back. Kidnapping, stalking, threats. I couldn't even wrap my mind around the words. "Where is Libby?" I asked, since he'd made reference to her coming back. "On a plane," Elisa answered. "Specifically, your plane." "I have a plane?" I was never going to get used to this. "You have several," Elisa told me. "And a helicopter, I believe, but that's neither here nor there. Your sister is en route to retrieve your things, as well as her own. Given the deadline for your move into Hawthorne House, and the stakes, we thought it best that you remain here. Ideally, we'll have you moved in no later than tonight." "The second this news gets out," Orin said seriously, "you'll be on the cover of every newspaper. You'll be the leading story on every newscast,
the number one trending topic on all social media. To some people, you'll be Cinderella. To others, Marie Antoinette. Some people would want to be me. Some people would hate me to the depths of their souls. For the first time, I noticed the gun holstered to Oren's side. "It's best you sit tight," Oren said evenly. "Your sister should be back tonight." For the rest of the morning, Elisa and I played what I had mentally termed the uprooting Avery's life in an instant game. I quit my job. Elisa took care of withdrawing me from school. "What about my car?" I asked. "Oren will be driving you for the foreseeable future, but we can have your vehicle shipped if you would like," Elisa offered, "or you can pick out a new car for personal use." For all the emphasis she put on that, you would have thought she was talking about buying gum at the supermarket. "Do you prefer sedans or SUVs?" she queried, holding her phone in a way that suggested she was fully capable of ordering a car with a mere click of a button. "Any color preference?" "You're going to have to excuse me for a second," I told her. I ducked back into my room. The bed was piled ridiculously high with pillows. I climbed up on the bed, let myself fall back on the mountain of pillows, and pulled out my phone. Texting, calling, and DMing Max all led to the same result. Nothing. She had definitely had her phone confiscated, and possibly her laptop, which meant that she couldn't advise me on the appropriate response when one's lawyer started talking about ordering a car like it was foxing pizza. This is unreal. Less than 24 hours earlier, I'd been sleeping in a parking lot. The closest I'd come to splurging was the occasional breakfast sandwich. "Breakfast sandwich," I thought. "Harry," I sat up in bed. "Elisa, if I didn't want a new car, if I wanted to spend that money on something else, could I?" Bankrolling a place for Harry to stay and getting him to accept it wouldn't be easy, but Elisa told me to consider it handled. That was the world I lived in now. All I had to do was speak, and it was handled. This wouldn't last. It couldn't. Sooner or later, someone would figure out that this was some kind of screw-up, so I might as well enjoy it while it lasts. That was the number one thought in my mind when we went to pick up Libby. As my sister stepped out of my private jet, I wondered if Elisa could get her into the Sorbonne, or buy her a little cupcake shop, or... "Libby!" Every thought in my head came screeching to a halt the moment I saw her face. Her right eye was bruised and swollen, nearly shut. Libby swallowed but didn't avert her eyes. "If you say, 'I told you so,' I will make butterscotch cupcakes and guilt you into eating them every day." "Is there a problem I should know about?" Elisa asked Libby, her voice deceptively calm as she eyed the bruise. "Avery hates butterscotch," Libby said, like that was the problem. "Elisa," I grated out, "does your law firm have a hitman on retainer?" "No," Elisa kept her tone strictly professional. "But I'm very resourceful. I could make some inquiries." "I legitimately cannot tell if you are joking," Libby said, and then she turned to me. "I don't want to talk about it, and I'm fine. But I'm fine." I managed to keep my mouth shut, and all of us managed to make it back to the hotel. The plan was to finish up a few final arrangements and leave immediately for Hawthorne House. Things did not go exactly according to plan. "We have a problem." Oren didn't sound overly bothered, but Elisa immediately put her phone down. Oren nodded to our suite's balcony. Elisa stepped outside, looked down, and swore. I pushed past Oren and went out on the balcony to see what was going on. Down below, outside the hotel's entrance, hotel security guards were struggling with what appeared to be a mob. It wasn't until a flash went off that I realized what that mob was. Paparazzi. And just like that, every camera was pointed up at the balcony. At me.